Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening on Amazon Music is included with your Prime membership. Just head to amazon.com/adfreenewspodcasts to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Enjoy thousands of Acast shows ad-free for Prime subscribers. Some shows may have ads.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
We acknowledge the Yuggera and Kaurna nations as traditional custodians of the land on which we work, live and learn, and their continuing connection with the land, waters and community. We pay our respects to them and their elders past and present.
All content related to this program is for general informational purposes only and contains stories and discussions around mental health that may be disturbing to some listeners. If you are concerned about yourself or someone you know, please seek professional individual advice and support. More details are contained in our show notes.
Fresh out of their latest talk series after their sweeping win of the Angsty Awards this year, Toxic Positivity joins us to talk about all things motivational and their talk show, Just Get It Done. Here's a clip from their show.
I used to feel like I couldn't, but then I decided to feel like I could. I used to hate mornings, but now I choose good vibes only. I used to feel bad about my life, then I told myself other people have it worse. Just get it done.
Toxic Positivity, welcome. It's been a while since we chatted. You've been busy spreading your good vibes around.
Yes, Interrogator. As you can hear from the clip of my latest talk series, Just Get It Done, people are motivated by my message.
You talk about this notion of choice, of just getting in there and getting it done. Is it really as simple as that?
Everyone has got a choice, Interrogator. That moment I chose to just get it done was a real game changer for me.
It sounds like you've landed on a magic pill there. So is it about changing the belief? Is there a process behind that?
Change the belief? No, just make a different choice. Just get it done. I literally took myself by the collar one day in front of the mirror and I said, Toxic Positivity, you just need to believe you can.
But what was the actual process? There must be something you did.
No, I just made a choice. Everyone has choices, Interrogator. And if you choose good vibes only, that's what you'll get.
So do you believe that everyone can just choose to be happy?
100%.
Okay, so what about people who are in situations they didn't choose, like underpaid workers, for example?
Choose to get a better job. Just get it done.
What about rising rents and housing affordability?
Stop renting. Choose to buy your own house. That avocado toast will still be there when you've paid it off.
Okay, so what about people who have lost everything because of the climate-related floods or fires?
A great example. They've still got their health. They can just choose to rebuild. Just get it done.
But people died in those floods and fires.
Look, I am not claiming to be able to solve all of the world's problems, but I can say that I've turned my life around.
Right. So your show, Just Get It Done, is all about that. But there have been reports about things being toxic behind the scenes despite its good vibes only approach.
It was their choice to be negative when they knew it was a good vibes only show.
So how did you address their actual concerns about harassment and misconduct?
In the end, we had to just get it done. We have got people with the right attitude working in the team now who know what happens if they don't choose good vibes only.
What about the sexual harassment claims?
You know, I choose to be flattered when someone whistles at me.
Some of them said they were bullied and unfairly managed.
You know me, Interrogator. It is all about choice. And they chose to have an issue with my feedback. As it turns out, there are plenty of other people who really love working on my show.
So what happened to those employees that flagged issues?
All the staff involved have each made a better choice for themselves and decided to work somewhere else. In the end, they just got it done. Good vibes only.
Choice, hey? How much of it is ours to make and how much of it is forced upon us?
This is Reframe of Mind,
where we deep dive into discussions about mental health, joined by some of Australia's leading minds to expand our understanding of the world and ourselves.
Because we don't exist in a vacuum, and the way that we talk about mental health shouldn't either. We're your hosts, Louise Poole and Andy Leroy.
This question of deliberate change versus forced change has really got us analysing our past choices. Kind of wondering if we've ever really been motivated to make a change or if all the changes that we've made have been reactive.
Yeah, we got to this point a couple of episodes ago, actually, where we realised that so many of these big decisions we've made throughout our lives, they kind of came about because we felt backed into a corner.
Yeah, it's that I'm fucking done moment, which I think is what we labelled it as.
I'm fucking done with this. It's also known as the I just fucking can't anymore moment, and the I'm so done with this shit moment.
I need to change. Something needs to change.
Yeah, it's that situation where we've been ignoring something or pushing aside our feelings about something or the circumstances, and it builds and it builds and it builds until you hit that overwhelm and you can't deal with it anymore. So it explodes or it implodes, and it kind of forces you into making some kind of change.
Like one of those fire hydrants that just sprays its contents all over the street.
Been a few episodes since you've had an analogy.
It has been a while. I thought I'd sneak one in.
Like a fire hose that sprays it all over the street.
We all hold the hose, don't we? Really? Metaphorically? Because making no decision or not listening to how we're really feeling for a long time is really making a decision to force ourselves into a place where we must take action.
And last episode, we spoke to some of Australia's leading women of STEM about the science of changing our thinking, what's actually possible, what's going on in our brains and our bodies, and how we can deliberately choose to make change that supports good, sustainable mental health.
One of those experts was leading Australian neuroscientist in occupational therapy and stroke rehabilitation and recovery research, Professor Leanne Carey from the Florey Institute. Leanne has seen incredible results in stroke recovery and told us about how our behaviour changes our brain and vice versa.
I think it's really that because there's a force, it's a challenge for it, so that the person, you know, there's part of the network that's not working properly, so there has to be some way of trying to reconnect between those parts that are working and or to help support some of that breakdown in a particular region that might have occurred. So I suppose when you use the word more moldable, it's almost a need base because of the challenge, and whether or not it's more moldable, or whether it's that it has to be molded because there's these gaps going on. And, you know, we often think about, you know, how we change the brain to change the behaviour, but really it's also both ways, how we change the behaviour to change the brain. So there's a two-way process going on.
How important is the link of the meaningful nature activities when you're looking at helping someone to retrain their brain?
I think that's really important because if we think about our brain being a network to help us do things and to achieve a goal, if that goal is meaningful, it already, the person is already working with you to achieve that, and it's focused so that there's the opportunity to then call on the parts of the network that are important to that particular task. And if I give one example, so we work on actually helping people regain a sense of touch and use it in everyday activities. And there's different layers to the goals that are meaningful for them. It might be first the goal of the sensation, just to feel if there's a difference between two surfaces, through to the goal of being able to hold a fork without dropping it, for example. So the meaningfulness is really critical to get that buy-in and then the steps along the way to achieve that goal.
So if having a meaningful goal is the key to motivation to take action that builds the new neural pathways and changes the brain, what are our goals, Andy? And have we ever actually set them consciously on purpose?
That's a very good question. That question around what motivates our desire for change. Have we been moving towards something we want to achieve or moving away from something that we don't want to experience anymore?
Another guest from earlier in the season, diversity trans relator Sally Goldner AM, knows plenty about this and hinted that making a change can often involve much more than making a choice.
It might mean that people have to face some of their emotions, and whether that involves mental health work or sitting with their feelings, whether it means, when we can, going to a gym and hitting a punching bag, whatever works, it's about that perhaps unlearning or unblocking in a sense. And some people might not do that. It's the emotions are too big, they don't know how to deal with it, they're too scary. And so you're not going to win them all, but it is about trying to appeal to a sense of logic and humanity. I think it's about both. And that also leads into issues about gender in leadership in lots of ways, which is also another 24-hour pet topic. Yes. So there's just so much that comes into this. Ultimately, though, we've got to take that responsibility for ourselves. And this is why that's a pet topic, a bit of a button, so to speak, is for the last, at least in Australia, 25 years, it seems we've heard so much about individual freedom. But freedom and responsibility need to be closely balanced for each individual and for groups and society as a whole. And I think a lot of times we've lost track of responsibility. And in the end, we have to take responsibility for all our choices. And some are simple. If there's a red light ahead, we'll stop because that's a responsible thing to do. Well, we hope anyway. But, I just feel a lot of the time people won't take responsibility for their choices and likely consequences. So it is about that form of logic, but it is also about respecting that people have deep-rooted feelings.
So taking responsibility for our own choices, easier said than done, I think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
it's hard, isn't it? Like,
well, as soon as somebody kind of brings out that word responsibility, then it seems like that people want to play a blame game and turn it into, well, it's all your fault, or point fingers or something like that. And it's not about that. In the context that Sally talks about it, I can't speak for Sally, obviously, but what I get from what Sally says is that as adults, we need to really have a look at ourselves and take responsibility for our own actions, our own reactions, and have a bit of a sense of our own part in the interactions that take place. So, the story that's been running from the beginning of this series for me is that I lost my dad and that there was a deterioration around that time between me and others in my family. And I suppose looking at the pattern of my family, there have been times in my extended family and, back generations where there's been a falling out between, a couple of people, and it can go for years.
That's such a common story though, isn't it? Like,
it is.
Whole family fallouts and ongoing grudges and you did this and they did that. And sometimes it feels like no one taking responsibility for their own choices in those arguments.
Yeah. So, I've had a couple of brief conversations with one of those family members, and it kind of got to a point where, some of the conversation was getting quite productive around acknowledging what happened and, that we obviously didn't mean to harm each other and stuff like that. So that was understood. But then as the conversation progressed, it became more about you did this and you did this and you did this. And that's where it starts to get overwhelming again, because it starts to feel like an attack. At each point I acknowledge and I said, look, I'm sorry, but also this and this is what you did. And so I started to kind of get a bit of a sense that there was a bit of an imbalance there as well, because while I was apologising, I wasn't getting anything back in return.
Yeah.
I suppose where I'm at with this part of the story is that I'm not taking any proactive action to try and heal that, because I've thought, okay, well, if what it's going to result in is me actually just acquiescing and going back to open quotes normal, close quotes, then that's not what I'm up for anymore. I actually want to have a good relationship with these people. I don't want that to be one of a power play or one where, remember that thing you did X amount of years ago.
Remember that thing you said when you were 7?
Yeah. Because, I fully take responsibility for what I did around that time. Grief aside and shock aside and all that kind of stuff that comes with the death of a family member aside, I have no intention intention of wearing that as any kind of excuse for things I said or did, because those things that I said and did were ultimately not directly related to that death. They were actually related to years and years of built up stuff, like we were talking about at the opening of the episode. It chips away at you over so many years, and then something significant happens, and then boof.
Implode and explode.
Implode and explode, and no glitter.
Unfortunately, no glitter at all.
No glitter.
So you think that's a situation of keeping it in over and over, keeping in the way that you feel and never really making a decision to address it until the pressure cooker builds and the fire hydrant bursts and the situation with the death of your dad and the overwhelmment of that emotion in there was kind of the trigger that it just caused.
It was definitely a catalyst.
It's the catalyst that caused the burst, but it wasn't the thing that caused the pressure build-up.
Yeah. Well, you see, you know, one of the comments that I received being, you know, I'm too old for this shit, when I was talking about something that had upset me, is really just a repeat of shutdowns that I'd received throughout all of my life, you know, that I was being dramatic or that I was just being stupid or whatever. So came to a point within me where I thought, okay, well, I'm not being heard. And if I'm not going to be heard, I'm not going to progress this conversation. There's no point putting myself through that because at the moment, I don't know how to effectively have that conversation. Mm. You know, if I can't actually use my voice effectively and be heard and for that not to be skewed into something like me trying to have an ulterior motive and gain power, that's not what it's about. It's about trying to actually level things out and have a respectful relationship. But if that isn't something that is seen that way by those other people, then there's no point in me expending all of that energy continually to try and fix something that ultimately is just going to land me back in the same frustrated place.
So when we talk about the motivation to choose or to choose to change, and we had that wonderful episode last week from the Women of STEM that had so many great resources on the actual practical, tangible steps that we can use to change.
Mm.
I mean, we even heard again from Leanne earlier this episode that it really is about having that, finding that motivation that's meaningful enough. What do you think it was that, yes, that was the moment that the pressure cooker burst, that it exploded or imploded, but why were none of the other times that you swallowed down the fact that you weren't expressing how you really felt enough motivation to change, to start making a choice for a healthier relationship with family members?
Yeah, that's a good question, Louise. Thanks for asking. I actually think that...
can I have my $170 psychologist money now, please?
Yeah, sure. Look, for me, I think it was an acute awareness that I was alone now in that moment, in that space, because, you know, the leading limb of my family tree had died. My brothers were actually at the head of their own families, and so their traditions and things continued, but being a gay man who doesn't have children of his own, then that sets me outside of that family now. You know, like we're still obviously related. There's still that shared history and all of that, but the context of that relationship completely changed. So, you know, in that time and space where they had their families around them to provide support and comfort, I was like a third wheel.
Mm.
And I may or may not have been, you know. I'm sure that people involved would say, well, no, we didn't believe that at all. We don't believe that at all. You were shutting us out. And maybe I was.
That was going to be my next psychologist question is, have you considered now that you're removed from the incident, that the hindsight has passed, yes, that they might have been argumentative at the time because they're also in a place of hurt and no one really likes to be called out on things and they probably did feel called out. Mm. But what might have been the motivation for them making the choices that they've made too.
Yeah, there's a whole lot of other stuff over a number of years that built up to that moment too. So it's difficult to talk about these things in isolation. So when I say that that realization to me kind of felt like the motivating factor in me exploding like I did, there's a combination of things and interrelationships and being caught in the middle of other people's arguments and fights and that sort of thing over a long period of time that I'd really just had enough of. I decided that I wasn't going to actually be a part of that anymore. Taking the point that Leanne makes about making that kind of change, for me, that was a massive step because I'd always considered myself quite close to my family. And yet here was a move where I was actually breaking out of that mold and I was actually changing the script. So I guess where my mind goes with that kind of breakaway is that I knew that I needed to have a different quality of relationship with these people. And I also knew that to just go through the same old patterns of I'm sorry, forgive me, I was bad boy, that kind of stuff was not going to work for me because that wasn't going to change the dynamics of any of that. I really felt that I needed to remove myself entirely from the dynamics of those relationships so that I could really get a good sense of myself and what I actually wanted and needed.
In that motivation for change, were you running towards clarity and empowerment for yourself, or were you running away from being a part of that?
To be fair, I was definitely running away from what I just did not want any part of anymore. I didn't want to be piggy in the middle. I didn't want to have any of those poor relationship things going on. I've seen how things transpired for other people who have gone before me, and I saw the impact on them emotionally. And I knew that if I actually slipped into those behaviors and allowed those people to continue with the way they actually treat people and allow them to do that to me, then I would be in a pretty vulnerable mental state.
I think the good thing is that we know from people we've spoken to since we've been putting together this series and the work that we've done on ourselves is that even if we started in that place of fuck it, I'm done, we can change our motivation.
Of course.
We can change now what we choose. We can stop running from something and start heading towards something.
There comes a turning point because you can only run away from something for so long before you start running towards something else, I think.
And making a conscious decision about what you're running towards. Otherwise, you're just on autopilot running to the next thing.
Yeah.
And then you'll run away from that.
Well, yeah, exactly. So the important thing is that once you've run away from what it is that you can no longer bear, you need to actually pause. You need to take time for yourself. This is for me. This is relevant to me. Other people might process things completely differently to me, and that's for them. But for me, I really felt that I needed to actually get myself out of that, and I needed to take whatever time it took for me to actually connect with what I need and then reform relationships where appropriate, because it's not always appropriate to go back to those relationships either. I really felt that I needed to acknowledge that I've actually got the right to feel equally upset about what transpired, you know, and not to have to be the peacemaker, because that's the role that I typically took. You know, I've said that I've got stuck in the middle of people's fights before, essentially, and that's because, you know, I want to be the peacemaker. I want to be the neutral party. I want to be Switzerland. You know, if somebody comes and bitches about something,
neutral anymore.
Well, I know, right? Hello. Neither am I. So it got to the point where I just didn't want to have someone coming to me and bitching about the other person, and then that other person coming and bitching about that other person. But of course, I wouldn't go and relay those messages to those other people because I didn't want to get involved with any of those tiffs or any of those fights. And really, I didn't even want them to come bitching to me. Like, I really just wanted to have an equal, loving relationship with these people, but it's not something that they were able to offer. And
not to be honest, hashtag good vibes only.
No, it's no hashtag good vibes only there, sadly. but, you know, this peacemaking thing needs to come from both sides.
Yeah.
You know, everybody needs to take ownership for what they've played in whatever has happened. I just came to that point, like I said, where I needed to actually be still with myself and address the core issues, which, you know, is not necessarily a quick and easy process. So
the action you took in that was cutting communication with said parties.
Mm-hmm. Just to give myself the space to process things and get some clarity around it as well, you know. Like, I've never said that I will never, ever speak to this person ever again in my whole life. But also within that, I've also said that, you know, they need to take responsibility for their part in things as well. I'm not going to walk into a conversation and have it pick up exactly where it left off 2 years ago. So at some point, you know, it's becoming quite clear that this stalemate that I've created for myself is one that could continue, you know, but also is one that I do feel that I need to take some action on, that there needs to be something that happens to resolve it one way or another, whether that action is to say, you know, let's talk this out and let's build a respectful relationship, or whether it, in talking things out, it's decided, look, you know, clearly we have nothing in common other than the accident of our birth, as Joe Forgas might say.
Mm.
And the action is to say, well, let's just kind of wish each other well and live a happy life. So it's about kind of, I suppose, a bit of a change in thinking around the approach to that, which I'm kind of starting to kind of, you know, have a bit of a different angle to, have a bit of a different think about.
Excellent. Because we certainly have had a lot of people be able to help us with this idea about changing our thinking and the work that goes on behind this. Including Associate Professor Kimberly Norris of the University of Tasmania, who's told us that the way we think and the action that we take are closely related.
The thinking around the action actually changes the mood around the action.
I think I just found some motivation to iron those shirts.
I think I just found a whole new way to look at the housework. Instead of hating it, I could combine all the things that I hate in with my newfound anxiety time. Let's just do it all at once.
Well, fundamentally, what we're talking about is something that we've known for quite some time, which is the way we think affects the way we feel, and the way we feel affects the way we act. So if we can, you know, press on any one of those three components, we will affect change in the others.
And founder and CEO of Le Joie Skin, Daphne Kapitis, uses other people's words to motivate herself in a very particular way.
I would give them my assignments and they'd say, oh, you know, who helped you do that? Because they assumed that being the way I was, that I didn't have brains. Do you see these prejudices? It's silly.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like I didn't fit in the scientific norm. It's just silly. It's limiting on their part, not on mine. And I remember once there was a subject called reaction kinetics, which is physics and chemistry. And one of the guys next to me said, oh, you know, you'll never pass this one. It's a 15% pass rate. Now, that is enough to drive me mad. Okay. Tell me that I can't do something. And I go, thank you for that. That's exactly what I needed. I needed you to tell me that I can't do that. Now watch me. Now I never go back to the people. I never go back to these people to say, gee, thanks for that. Because of you, I got 95%. And I remember the lecturer walking in saying, Daphne Dimitriadis, reaction kinetics, stand up, 95%. I blitzed it. I couldn't believe it. But I never told anybody that behind the scenes my brain was hemorrhaging.
Some great words there from Daphne, and really, she's got such a way about it, hasn't she?
You know, I love Daphne's energy.
And I've got to say that, like, that whole thing of, well, you're going to tell me that I can't do this? Well, screw
I'm gonna
you.
Prove I'm going to show you.
I'm going to prove you wrong. I think I've done that myself a few times throughout my life.
Look, I think that's probably one of my key motivators for things. Like,
yeah.
Actually, my therapist would probably say I've spent most of my life trying to prove my father wrong in some way or another. Like that's been one of the major motivators for me. Prove he's wrong. Prove I'm worthy of this or worthy of that. But you know what? We've been down that path of trauma, so maybe I'll give you a fresh dump of trauma this time instead, a new story. Like,
yeah, I mean, what if the person that's telling you that you can't do something is actually you?
Which is very common, especially to me, I'm sure that a lot of people can relate to this, but that negative self-talk, you are your own harshest critic. You're the one telling yourself no, that you can't do it, that you can't do things, you can't be who you want to be, you can't live how you want to live. Well, a lot of reasons that you might tell yourself that, but it's so easy, isn't it? It's so easy to make those excuses and criticize yourself like that and tell yourself you can't be or do or have what you want.
It's almost like we gather the evidence, don't we? We hear whispers, we see things in the news, we hear attitudes in the community, whatever it takes to actually justify not taking action on something.
I'm pretty sure Joe Forgas might have been the one that told us that was confirmation bias, right?
Yeah.
That we keep finding that stuff around ourselves to support our own hypotheses, even if that hypothesis isn't true.
Yeah, definitely. And, you know, it can go on for years and have, like, really profound impacts on us at that really base level of who we are and what we actually need, what our needs are. I think you've had quite the journey with this,
you know, since turning 40, haven't you?
Well, even before turning 40. Here's a concept that, I mean, I think you've heard, but it might not be a common concept. Compulsory heterosexuality. That's the idea that when you're born, as you grow up, you are assumed to be heterosexual until otherwise evidenced, proven otherwise. I suppose. Until proven otherwise. And so we, as a society, make all these sort of sexuality and gendered assumptions about people and about ourselves based on this whole embedded concept of compulsory heterosexuality.
This can apply to anybody of any gender.
Yes. You know?
And note that we haven't said both genders because the there are more than one gender, you know, like I think we need to kind of make that pretty clear that that's our position as well, because this happens for people of all genders where they may be same-sex attracted, they may be, I don't know, they might be polyamorous. You know, there are things that don't fit within the typical boy-girl love scenario, and we're assigned a gender at birth and we're expected to conform to the norms of that gender in society. So compulsory sexuality.
You know what we call it on the internet?
Comp-het.
Comp-het. And I think it's for that reason. It's too long to type and it's too hard to say.
Absolutely. So comp-het shows up really early when you buy your little girl a dolly and you go, let's go play mummies and daddies. And you're the mummy. Yeah. Oh, how come you're pretending to be the daddy? No, no, no. You're the mummy. You're the mummy. That kind of shit, you know, so...
Or you tell your little boy that he's going to be a heartbreaker one day and all the girls are going to swoon as a baby. He's going to break some hearts.
There was a mum in the mother's group once that said to my mum, oh, he's got such kissable lips. I was like 8 years old.
Why was she thinking about kissing your lips?
I don't know, but I didn't have great lips.
Yeah, I don't know. Should we use that as one of the reviews for the podcast?
He's got great lips.
He's got kissable lips, age 8.
Yeah, it was a bit creepy, but anyway.
We'll file that under things you couldn't say in 2022 without being cancelled.
Where does that fit into comp hit?
I don't know. It was funny.
Anyway.
Though.
It was funny.
No, if, okay, so as the basis of things, comp-het, right? So for you, when you came out, you did struggle like those first early years trying to identify why you weren't really into women and why you were finding yourself more attracted to men.
Had a girlfriend, the kissable lips, didn't want to kiss.
Had a girlfriend that you wrote love letters to, but...
Yeah, same girlfriend.
Yeah, not as great a love letters as you wrote to that other dude. See an episode two episodes ago for that one. So for you, that was a strong feeling. You knew that women didn't fit.
Yeah. I knew within the core of my soul that it just wasn't right.
So the difference in that feeling and the feeling that I suppose you get from that kind of compulsory heterosexuality, I think that comp-het is really common in people who are bisexual or pansexual and they don't know it yet, because if you feel so strongly about not being attracted to women, that's a great indicator that you're probably not attracted to women.
Yeah.
But if someone is bisexual, they might be occasionally attracted to a woman and attracted to a man and attracted to any other gender. So when comp-het is a thing, you think, oh, okay, well, I guess I'm not gay because I am attracted to some women.
Yeah, I think really, you know, there is a massive shift in thinking that needs to happen where people think in terms of genitalia. Pure and simply, you know, like you've got this, that goes with that. Thank you,
Suzanne. Especially your friend with the lips.
Well, I know, right? So there's little room for acknowledgement there that people are actually attracted to people, not to genitalia.
Mm, it's very black and white kind of.
It is, yeah. Everybody's experience is different with this. So for me, not being bi or pan, I knew that I wasn't attracted to the opposite sex. So the way that manifested for me, which, you know, isn't necessarily the way it manifests for everybody, you know, some people do actually go down that comp-het path and take a wife and have children. And then 20 years later, oh, actually, you know, and then they go, oh, they're just bisexual. They're just bisexual. Well, number one, just bisexual isn't a thing. It's actually maybe they are bisexual. Maybe they suppressed their sexuality because they felt that they couldn't actually do anything otherwise. There are all sorts of things that happen psychologically and socially that prevent people from being able to comfortably come out as whatever they are when they need to.
And, you know, from a female point of view, a female presenting point of view is probably the better way of putting it, you get told these messages, these societal messages, and I think it's especially prevalent for women, and I really can't comment on it from a male point of view, but we almost, it's like the patriarchy has set it up so that the bar for men is so fucking low that we don't notice we're not all that interested because we think that's what the best we're going to get. That's the best we fucking deserve because the bar for them is so, it's through the floor low. Okay. How many women do you hear that aren't really sexually satisfied by their relationships? It's part of the expectation, isn't it? Like,
yeah. And also, you know, I mean, the guys might just be really bad at sex, but also, you know, like what's behind that lack of enjoyment as well? Like, is it that they're not actually attracted to them?
Oh, yeah, yeah. And again, this can only come from my perspective as we're set up with these expectations of you'll find a partner and
you'll settle down, you'll make yourself nice when he comes home from work and be the doting wife.
Okay. Well, and yeah, those were older expectations, but even in my, you know, generation of born in the 80s and I wasn't going to settle down and be the doting wife.
But you'd still do the bloody housework.
It's still up to the woman to carry the majority of the housework, right? Mm. Shouldn't be. And yet how many women end up doing that? Because the bar for men is through the fucking floor. And I'm struggling to give it a clear definition because it permeates so many things. So it permeates the fucking fairy tales of the princess needing to be rescued by a man. Mm. He's done something to win her and now she belongs to him. You know, like so many women have shitty sex and shitty sex with their partners because, you know, you see, in the whole porn industry is set up, even the fucking lesbian porn industry is set up for the gratification of the man telling the story. So it's not...
It's the male gaze.
It's not focused on a woman's pleasure. It's a fucking pump and dump. When you're a woman and you're in a relationship, like half the time sex ends when he ends. So women quite are often very unsatisfied sexually because the pump and dump fucking dumps, goes to sleep and then starts snoring and you're left there going, that wasn't really that great for me.
Who's going to finish this now?
Who's going to finish this off? But... Hashtag
we laugh, but
hashtag
it's true.
Hashtag not all men. Some of them are, you know. My point isn't that all men are shit at sex. My point is that it's an expectation. It's something that we've internalized through these messages that we got. That's just how sex is. That's how relationships are. Even as a fucking strong feminist, still holding on to this idea that, well, it's my responsibility to be a fucking glory hole for his dick, even if I don't want to have sex, because it's part of the job. And everyone has relationships like that that aren't that fulfilling. What about the whole idea of orgasm in women? Like, we know that most women don't orgasm through penetration. It's through things like clitoral stimulation. And yet, all we ever see is all focused on penetration. Sex is focused on penetration because it's about how women and their bodies can serve men. And so even though, do you know what? The men fucking know that they have to stimulate the clitoris and they're like, oh, can't find it. And then they fuck it up and then they try and, or they push it too hard or they, you know, I mean...
You need like little markers, like little sticky tabs.
It's
like,
not that
push
fucking
here.
Hard. It's not fucking hard. It is not fucking hard. Because they don't want to communicate or listen or, you know, because it's about their self-gratification themselves. And the comp head of it all is that women are conditioned to accept that and told that that's just how it is. We kind of grow up believing that those are the relationships that you have. Well, you've got to make a trade-off. This guy's nice. You don't end up sexually satisfied. You're not really all that attracted to him, but that's okay because he's a nice person and maybe he'd make a nice father for the kids or he can provide.
He'd be a good provider, yeah.
Or something like that. You're like, oh, well, okay, that's just normal. all these things are normalised. This undervaluing of us as women, of accepting that relationships are like that. Like, yeah, it's okay for the woman to date because he's a nice personality, or, you know, he'll be a good provider, or whatever else that might be, even if she's not attracted to him, even if then their sex isn't that good. But he, you know, he's satisfied, so it's okay. And he chips in and he, you know, occasionally watches his own fucking kids and, you know, he helps her out with those kind of things. Or he might one day stack the dishwasher and say, I helped you out, honey, even though she's doing all the housework as well as working a job and doing all the main childcare. And it's all normalised.
Yeah, so it's accepted. Yeah.
It's accepted. So comphet occurs when you don't think to question that the reason that you find your husband is an unappealing fuckwit is because you're actually not into fucking men. We expect everyone feels like that. We're told everyone feels like this. They don't. There's actually some really nice men out there.
And there are some really happy heterosexual couples out there, you know, like this isn't a program about bashing heteros or anything
I got on my high horse because I've just thought about all the shitty fucking sex I've had with fucking pump and dump men that can't find the clitoris.
But this is coming from your perspective as well, in that, you know, it really started to dawn on you that actually it wasn't just a problem with the men and their behaviours. It was actually deeper than that for you.
Yeah. Hey there. Just wanted to take a little breather from today's episode and say thank you so much for listening to us. Make sure you never miss an episode by hitting the follow button on your podcast app now. And while you're there, we'd love it if you left us a review. It really does help to boost us so we can reach even more people. You can also check out our Patreon page to see how you can access even more content at patreon.com/reframeofmind. And remember to tell everyone you know about us, because the more people we get talking about mental health, the more supported we'll all be.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening on Amazon Music is included with your Prime membership. Just head to amazon.com/adfreenewspodcasts to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Enjoy thousands of Acast shows ad-free for Prime subscribers. Some shows may have ads.
Did I have too much of a shit on men?
Oh, it was a pretty big shit on men.
So I think that the point of my very long-winded explanation of compulsory heterosexuality, that really just sounds like me shitting on men.
I'll just get some TP.
It's really to point out the fact that so people can be something other than straight for a long time in life and not even realise it, because we're conditioned to expect certain behaviours and accept certain behaviours. A less aggressive way of defining that. When I was at school and I was first developing crushes on people, I never really felt like many of them were genuine crushes. I kind of had a criteria, like, is this person nice? Do they have nice eyes? You'll do.
I was a bit the same, actually. Yeah, I've got to admit, like, when the people in your peer group are talking about who's hot and who's not and that kind of thing, you kind of start to formulate opinions around that kind of stuff to actually be in with the peer crowd, because you don't want to seem different.
Because also you assume that everybody else is kind of thinking a similar way. Like, this is turning into such a graphic episode. But, okay, let's take a penis, for example,
sure.
Right? Now, like, if I was to show you a photo of an erect penis, would you go, all right, that's good, yep, I'm on board? Or would you go, I don't get it?
Oh, look, I've probably hopped on board a couple of times. But, you know, that's all in a consensual kind of manner.
You know, there's that whole thing with unsolicited dick pics, et cetera, and, you know, I've been the recipient of many unsolicited dick pics.
Never had any that weren't solicited.
I've seen many an unsolicited dick. The thing about it is that it is so normalised for that experience to happen to women that if I see a dick pic, I go, And I didn't realise until I actually was discussing it with one of my friends, a cisgendered woman, how she feels about getting the occasional dick pic. And she also feels like she could climb on it occasionally.
Right,
I didn't realise that it was a feeling of revulsion until I discussed it with somebody else, because I just thought everyone felt that way.
And that's not to condone the practice in any way, because it shouldn't be done unsolicited.
Oh, no, like. No, never. But, I mean, even a solicit, I would never ask someone for a dick pic. I don't want to see your fucking dick. Even solicited, no.
What about a click pic?
I got some tit pics recently, though.
How did that make you feel?
They were also unsolicited, so I also didn't want them. Please don't send unsolicited genitalia in any form.
That said.
I tried to get onto the other topic, and I still think I'm just shitting on men. Now I'm shitting I'm shitting on men sending unsolicited dick pics.
If that's where you need to be, that's where you need to be.
The point with that is that it wasn't even a question in my mind, am I actually attracted to someone other than cisgendered men? Because I honestly thought everyone felt the way that I felt. I thought that everyone expected sex in relationships to not be all that great.
That's kind of like that whole societal thing that comes from that sexual liberation and stuff as well, isn't it? It's like, oh, you just give it away, whatever. And I think, you know, to some extent we've kind of lost the intimacy of that. You know, like look how prolific porn is now and how people just go and switch on to any of those websites and can get it for free anytime. I had to actually get a chair and go to the top of my dad's cupboard to see porn when I was a teenager and then carefully put the tape back in its place so that it didn't look like it had been disturbed.
You don't want to wreck that VCR tape.
God, can you imagine if it got chewed up in the heads? How would I have explained that? Although, how would the conversation have ever come up? Because he certainly wouldn't have admitted that his porn tape had been chewed up. So, you know, win-win.
We have spoken before on the podcast about me getting to a point where I realized that I wasn't straight and how long that took me. I think it was 36 or 37 when I realized that the things that I felt weren't things that everybody else was feeling. Once I started to discover this idea of comp het and really look into why I felt the way that I felt, it kind of all unraveled. And then it's like it shines a light on all your past experiences and you go, okay, well, that's why I always said that I think that women are more attractive than men. And that's why I always felt uncomfortable if I was ever with a friend when she was changing and she didn't feel uncomfortable. And I'm like, where should I look? I don't feel like I should look, right? That's why I was sad that time that I was at the bar in Ballarat and this lovely woman came up and like bought me a drink and then we had a dance and then she like said, do you want another drink? And I said, yeah, give me a vodka cruiser. And then she came back with a beer with some raspberry in it. And then I was like, oh, that's a shame, because I thought like maybe we could go home together, but not if she's going to buy me a beer. And then I told that story as a joke. But now I think, actually, like... That's not something that straight people say. Do you know what straight people aren't doing? They're not Googling, am I gay, at 1 o'clock in the morning.
No, that's true.
They're not.
Yeah, there's very few of them doing that.
They're not on, you know, gay TikTok going, why do I keep getting served all these lesbian videos?
There's a gay TikTok?
Do you not know about lesbian talk and gay talk?
No.
Oh, we'll send you down that. We'll send you down that rabbit hole after this, you know.
Barely into ABBA talk. Come on.
Do you mean that people aren't all thinking these things? Are we really not all Googling these things? Like, it really shone a whole other light on all these past experiences that I hadn't even considered from. Because they were those emotions, those things that we talked about at the start of the episode. I was just pushing them down and pushing them down and pushing them down and just not dealing with it. Because I don't even know if I was all that aware of it, to be honest, because comp het's a genuine thing and I just thought this is how relationships were, and if this is how relationships are, then I don't really want them. And so I was never in a big rush to have relationships. And when I've had relationships, I've tried to make sure that they were people who I got along with more. And even when I've had, you know, relationships where I've had a lot of sex with the men, I've still kind of felt like I have to do this. And so it's really not until I think the last relationship where I was like, I fucking can't. I'm fucking.
You got to that point.
I'm fucking done.
Fucking over it.
I fucking can't, and I'm fucking done. I'm fucking sick of dicks.
Literally and figuratively.
So, cut to whatever it is, 2017, I think it was the marriage equality time, and I start to have those thoughts, and I'm in a relationship. I'm in a long-term relationship with a cisgendered man, and it really weighs on me all the time, over and over. And I was also suffering from the depression, the anxiety that we've spoke about on the show before. It wasn't related to that. There was certainly a part of it. Anything where you're, you know, hiding your identity from yourself is certainly all a part of it.
Bound to crop up with those sorts of things, yeah.
I did get to the point where I just couldn't stop thinking about it all the time. Like, he's asleep at night and I'm there on my phone on, like, gay Reddit. Is it normal to feel this way?
Am I gay? Am I a lesbian?
Do other people, blah, blah, blah. How do I know? How do I know if I'm gay? How do I tell someone? And then you go down the, I went down the path as well of going on some of these anonymous forums, like, have you stayed with your partner after you told them that you were gay? Because it's like, well, you know, I've spent a number of years with this person and I love them. I care about them. So I don't really want them out of my life, and I know that that's how relationships end, and then when that happens, that happens. So is it worth keeping it in, holding it in, and just staying in this relationship and never exploring that part of myself? Because I can't discount every interaction that I've had with men, because as much as I shat on men earlier in the conversation, there have been some wonderful men that I've seen and have had quite fulfilling sexual experiences with. The fact that they're rare is disappointing, but there have been some, and I can't discount the fact that I was very attracted to them.
That was also from that space of compete, though, wasn't it? You know, so I suppose, you know, where you're at from turning 37, the marriage equality survey, that sort of thing, that really started to trigger within you these other feelings you hadn't acknowledged before. And, you know, there's that kind of need to explore for you then, you know, whether those other feelings are legitimate, whether they're actually a part of wanting to run away from possibly a relationship that you didn't want to be in anymore. All those sorts of things, I think, started to culminate, didn't they?
You're preempting the next part of the story, though, aren't you?
Oh, I'm sorry.
You looked into your
I thought you were coming to...
I was. Yeah. You looked into your crystal ball. The next part of that is that eventually it got to the point where I couldn't not say something about the way that I was feeling about that inside. And I did think at the time, that partner at the time was, I thought he was supportive in that when he said, if it's something that you want to explore, then you can and we can stay together. And I actually felt like that gave me great relief at that time to know that the option was there.
Gave you a bit of space to kind of feel it was safe to explore.
But I also at that time was depressed for other reasons and really struggling with my mental health for other reasons. And so even though I had permission, I hope that came across as in commas, bolded and italicized, even though I had permission, I didn't, because I didn't have the energy to, I didn't have the energy to look after myself, let alone to bother trying to share any intimacy, emotional or physical, with anybody else. So it wasn't until, really until we began this process, until the forced change, the change of the things that I was running away from, you know, changing careers, leaving circumstances that were toxic, leaving situations behind that weren't working for me, us looking at starting a business and us starting to put together this podcast, that even though I had that permission all that time ago, that I actually started to feel better and like I might like to pursue something, or that there might be a bigger part of me there that feels like I'm missing out than what I was. And also questioning that whole permission thing as well, because fucking I don't need anybody's permission.
Yeah, because it's about you. It's not about them.
Back to the comp het and the male gaze, the idea of giving someone permission starts to feel like, and particularly was reinforced by conversations around it, like if you're going to go explore your sexuality with other women, other cisgendered women, because it was definitely a one penis policy, then
of course,
am I a part of that? What's in that for me?
Oh.
And so then that's actually not about your genuine care of me understanding this part of myself. It's once again life through the male gaze.
It's can I join in?
Mm.
Ew. I mean, really, like... Really?
Because the one penis policy, right? It's this idea that, oh, you can go sleep with anybody else, but only one penis. And I'm like, but if it's true to say that you can be in a relationship and then, like many polyamorous or open relationship couples do, set healthy boundaries, if it's true to say that you could explore your sexuality outside of this current relationship and set up systems of trust and blah, 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 then the quota of penis shouldn't matter. You should actually be free to explore your sexuality with whomever you want. So putting the penis quota on it, anybody, as long as I don't have a penis.
Yeah, it should be completely genitalia neutral.
It means that it was never about helping someone you care about. It was all about maybe this will lead to something for me, like a threesome, or I can watch.
Yeah, hot. So that really was a boundary that you weren't prepared to cross, though, isn't it?
No, because then it wouldn't have been about me and exploring something for me. It would have been, again, something for someone else in the relationship because society told me that I had to give him something for me to have anything for me.
That's right. Nothing for you without something for him.
When I started actively working on my mental health, I got to a point where I realized that I wasn't feeling bad about a lot of things anymore. I wasn't feeling depressed around the work stuff. I wasn't feeling depressed around stuff that we were doing in our business or in making content or in making friends or any of those things. But The area that kept falling down was in terms of sexuality and relationship. Because when I first started seeing a psychologist, when I first started to actually get help and take medication for my depression, she did say, "Do you want to discuss your relationship?" And I said, "I don't want to make any decisions based on how I feel now because I'm worried that I'll throw the baby out with the bathwater."
Yeah.
And because I do believe that things can change when you change the way that you feel about them, and that maybe things that seem like not healthy or problems, if I was feeling better in general, then, you know, maybe there wouldn't be so many arguments. Maybe I'd feel more
might
like...
Might be such an issue.
Might feel more like having sex in my relationship. Those things might not be an issue. If I can get myself into a place where I feel better, then I could, you know, make an informed decision and see if that fixes it. And so as I started to do the work of feeling better and started to feel better in all those other things, it really became apparent that it wasn't me.
As you started to get a better understanding of yourself and what you needed, then it became patently clear that you weren't the issue.
I mean, I'm still plenty of issues, but
that wasn't the issue at hand. Like the issue that you were looking at thinking was the problem wasn't actually the issue that was the problem.
And some of those times when I started to feel better and then was questioning whether it's the fact that I'm in a relationship with a man or if it's the fact that I'm in a relationship that's not working, that's not healthy, I don't know which one it was. And so there are a lot of nights where instead of Googling, am I gay, at 1 a.m, then I switch to Googling, am I pretending to be gay because I just don't want to be in a relationship anymore? Am I trying to convince myself that I'm gay as an excuse to leave a relationship?
I'm kind of guessing the answers on that thread might have led to the same place as the other one.
What, unsolicited dick pics?
No, the question of am I gay in general.
do you think that straight people are sitting up late at night Googling, am I pretending to be gay to get out of a relationship?
Probably not.
So after I was advised by strangers on the internet that I am in fact not Googling something commonly Googled by straight people, I think that voice just, it got too loud. It got so loud that the unattraction I felt towards a cisgendered male, all of that, I got to a point where on my 40th birthday, I imploded. Instead of having a good birthday in the car on the way home from my birthday lunch, arguing with my partner at the time and telling him that I think that maybe I'm gayer than we think I am.
Did you pull out the Kinsey scale?
Should we put the Kinsey scale in the show notes?
Maybe we should, for anyone who's curious.
Yeah, so that conversation in the car on the way home from my birthday, it was... I don't know if I can do this anymore because I don't know if I'm lying to you and lying to me, if maybe the fact that I don't feel that this is working, the fact I don't feel happy, the fact that I don't feel attracted, if it means that in fact that I'm not interested in cisgendered men at all. And that was a hard conversation to have because I was very scared of leaving that relationship because it was something that I'd invested a lot of time in. I'd invested a lot of money in. It was sunk cost fallacy.
Sunk cost phallus.
Sunk. It was sunk cost phallus. Can we put that in the quote for the episode?
Go on.
So, yeah. So Louise and Andy talk about sunk cost phallus in today's episode of Reframe of Mind. And what that would mean for me if that relationship was to end because, you know, it had been 5 years or so. We were in the process of setting up our business and this was all I was doing financially for an income. There was no support network of another job. There was just
you and me in our separate rooms in separate states
and
build something.
And my credit card and my savings. And they were slowly going up and down at the same time and not in the good way. So if I put this out there and this caused that relationship to end, then I take on all those costs of the household on my own. And what does that mean for us?
Yeah, that was a massive risk. But, you know, I think also from that perspective, I think you kind of realised pretty well that you couldn't just base your situation on that alone, hey? You know, like you needed to actually be true to yourself as far as what you needed personally.
Yeah. I jump back on the internet where all my anonymous friends are on my birthday.
The little community.
The 1 a.m. community. And, well, this is the comment that I wrote on my birthday. I turned 40 today, and for some reason, after I left lunch with my friends, when my cishet male partner and I were driving home, we got talking about sex versus love. He previously told me if I'd wanted to explore my sexuality, I could. I only started to admit to myself that I was pan a couple of years ago and rarely mentioned it in real life. I feel like I don't get to belong in LGBT spaces when I haven't had the experience of dating anyone other than cis men. And even though I had permission to explore, I hadn't done it because I felt like that would be cheating because I want an emotional connection as well. Then he said, "It's okay if you're gay, you know." And it all flooded out. All the times I sit here wondering if I'm more gay than I admit, the fact that I haven't been interested in a sexual relationship with him in years, wondering if any of my relationships with men have been anything other than compet, and if it turns out that I am, how it will change my life and how I'll have to set him free because it's not fair just to keep him around as a backup plan. So I guess it's true what people say about turning 40, gaining self-confidence and caring less about what other people think. Lol. I don't know what's next, but it feels like relief.
It's a pretty powerful post for your 40th birthday.
Happy birthday.
Woo. Glitter? No glitter.
No, no glitter. Fuck, I didn't even get me a cake.
What?
I had to go pick my own birthday present too. Like, I mean, I know.
Self-serve birthday.
Look, let's put it like this. At that point when I posted that, I actually thought, oh, no, it's going to be really sad to end the relationship. And since having ended the relationship, total mindset ending not so great. So very happy to have ended the relationship.
Things work out, you know. Was it difficult for you to hear people kind of reflecting back to you in those forums that, honey, straight people don't ask those questions?
Not difficult, but more that I felt like I was making it up, that I'm exaggerating, especially having had no relationships with anybody that wasn't a cis man as well. Like, yeah, so even now that I haven't been in a relationship with somebody for probably 6 months, I still think, am I making it up? Whereas I'm not really interested in being in a relationship with anybody currently. I'm in a process of healing, I suppose. I'm certainly not interested in dating cis men, I'll tell you that.
When you're ready to explore, there's going to be a lot of glitter.
There's going to be Louise's sexy slutty times.
Yeah. Yeah. I'll hand over the baton that's been gathering dust for so long.
Oh, thank you.
So when it comes down to the changes that you did make as a result of everything you were feeling and everything that culminated, I'll ask you the same question you asked me. Do you feel like you were running away from something or running towards something?
Away, absolutely, yes. Absolutely. I wasn't making a conscious choice. I wasn't choosing to run towards something. I was letting it build up until it imploded and till I was backed into an I just fucking can't live like this anymore. I just fucking can't not be authentic. I just fucking can't go through another day without saying these things. To hell with the consequences, because it might kill me if I don't fucking say it. And I just fucking can't do another 50 years of my life in this situation without actually ever knowing the answer. Because even if I thought I was making it up, I'd at least owed myself the chance to find out. So no, all of that choice was made from I just fucking can't. Not out of possibility, out of hope, out of going towards
the truth
something.
Catches up with us in the end. You know, that's what happened, isn't it? You know,
yeah.
This is what therapy sessions are all based on, that, you know, we kind of come to our truth and need to find a way to kind of actually deal with that and to actually learn to say the things for ourselves that we need to say. So sometimes those things are hard to say, and sometimes they're hard to hear, though. You know, but it doesn't mean that we shouldn't say them.
You know, there's a Joe Bomb to go with everything from the Scientia professor, Joe Forgas from the University of New South Wales. When we spoke to him, he really made us question our own thoughts about what isn't acceptable for other people to say.
I think speech should not ever be regulated and suppressed, because speech is the medium whereby people express their beliefs and their values. And however much you disagree with it, if you want them to change, you got to hear it. You will not change them if you prohibit it. And that's why I think a lot of the current trends of political correctness and woke and cancel culture are totally counterproductive, because if you start regulating speech and you equate speech with actually action and behavior, which might be criminally punishable, you stop all possibility of social progress and discourse. We have to be able to hear what anybody thinks, even if you disagree with it. And there are actually in liberal democracies very few examples up to this point of states trying to regulate speech. I mean, one example I can think of in Germany, you are not allowed to be a Holocaust denier. In Canada, Jordan Peterson has been on record for objecting for complied speech, where people have to use particular personal pronouns. I personally would be a libertarian. I think all forms of speech, even Holocaust denial, should be allowed, so we can debate it and know about it and do something about it. Suppressing speech is never the solution to solve any problem.
So if someone says something that you don't want to hear, like your partner tells you that they wonder if they might be more gay than you thought they would be after five years of a relationship.
Or a family member says that you acted really shit around a particular period of time.
Where's the line at how much you have to hear?
And it definitely doesn't mean that we should accept any malicious language. You know, that fuck you too stance that we often get to in these situations, as hard as they are, they do serve to remove us from a bad situation in the short term. But you know what? That still needs to be processed. We can't just keep that stance going. It's not sustainable forever. So, you know, like I was saying earlier in the episode around those conversations about that time around when my dad died, the conversations that I had with one of my relatives was hard to hear some of the issues they had with me, but I listened.
Yeah.
I was prepared to listen and to give. The flip side of that was that when I attempted to be heard myself, I was shut down with, I'm too old for this shit. So, you know, that was just with that regular old expectation that the grievances have been aired, therefore things can just go back to normal and we can just pretend it didn't happen, which wasn't going to happen.
and in that situation for me, when I finally said the things that I needed to say, I actually did. I felt like I was heard. It wasn't until later that I felt like I was unheard. You know, then it became obvious that I was only ever told the words that they thought I wanted to hear.
For their own gain. It's always about their own gain. It's the same with mine. Like, okay, so we've had this conversation. Let's shut it down now and therefore we can just It's all good.
My relationship didn't end on my 40th birthday. It didn't end for another couple of months. And the sexuality wasn't the trigger in the end, that it wasn't the thing that pulled the trigger.
No.
So.
No, it wasn't.
That's a whole other story.
Well, this thing about using your voice, though, isn't it? You know, like we go in good faith to have these conversations to say, look, you know, we need to actually make this right. So from my point of view, like, I didn't expect to land in a position of feeling like the naughty child and being shut down. That's kind of where I shut them out. And to some extent, I still shut them out because, you know, by not having that full two-way conversation about everything thing that happened, the only normal that happens is me acquiescing, towing their line. You know, my needs and boundaries are ignored, they're not met, and for them everything's fine because theirs are, but that's not how it's not how it should be. And it really does take that goodwill on both sides to actually come in, listen to each other, have an honest conversation, and then take responsibility for their own part in that so that things can actually heal. But if it's unbalanced, then that's just going to go back into those old patterns that are unhealthy. And we stop ourselves from having those conversations because they feel like they're going to hurt so much.
They're so uncomfortable. So when it comes to making decisions and having conversations that we need to, are we just too focused on short-term pain?
Well, somebody who gave us a really good perspective on that is Professor Marie Thiessen, AC.
She's the director of the Matilda Centre for Research in Mental Health and Substance Use.
Part of that balance of balancing out whether you make one choice or another is tied up in short-term and long-term. So the lolly can be really gratifying in the short term, but we know we're going to be putting on weight or we're going to be increasing the risk of having tooth decay or increasing the risk of longer-term heart disease. We do often think about what's right up in front of us and then discount what the consequences could be longer-term. So one of the things is actually writing it down and acknowledging that there are short-term and that there are longer-term consequences to what we do. We are incredibly clever as humans at discounting those longer term. It's like we're sort of inbuilt bravery machines. We look at the upfront and we don't think about the longer term and sometimes the more serious harms. And our brains are wired for that, so it's a challenge to make sure that we identify those and take those into consideration when we're making our choices.
Tomorrow's another day. Is this the long-term thinking that you're thinking about?
Yeah, that type of long-term thinking. That's a great example. You got the chocolate block there. I'll put it off. I'll have it today, but I'll put off the change to tomorrow. I think that comes back to where it's a good idea of thinking about what are the good things about doing that. You're going to get the initial gratification. What are maybe not some of the good things about doing that? Tomorrow and tomorrow and tomorrow you'll have to do, if it's eating that chocolate bar, the accumulation of that sugar will end up, you'll have to do a lot of exercise in order to counter that. So it being really explicit about the decision isn't just about what's happening to you right now. The decision is also about what's going to happen in next week when every day you eat that chocolate bar.
Reminds me of that, is it the marshmallow experiment where they put the marshmallows in front of the kids in a room and said you can either have one now or you can have five if you wait 15 minutes and no one could wait 15 minutes, I think.
That's so true. And kids are really good. Kids are hardwired to get those marshmallows early. As kids, you know, the part of their brain that should kick in and allow them to do all this decisional work, the front part of the brain, the prefrontal cortex, isn't well developed. So it absolutely, they're really wired for taking risks. And you actually want them to. You want them to experience lots of things in life. That's why kids particularly have trouble with that marshmallow experience. Adults, we got a bit more brain development. We should be able to kick into gear that decision part of our brain.
If we intellectually know that we're better off waiting for 15 marshmallows later instead of one marshmallow now, or if we're better off, you know, making a healthier choice because alcohol, drugs, they're not doing good stuff for us in the long term, but we emotionally go for the one marshmallow or the booze, how do we switch that thinking? Like, is there steps that we can take that actually help us make those long-term goals something that we can feel like we're achieving now?
It's emotionally and it's also through habit. So we are also excellent at picking up cues and habit and the things that we would normally do. So part of the way of dealing with this is creating some new habits. So the habit might be that you have 2 or 3 or 4 glasses of wine, even 2 glasses of wine in the evening. Maybe you have a glass of wine and a glass of water. You get into the habit of always having a glass of water in between having the glass of wine. So part of it is unlearning and then learning new, healthier habits so that they become, and practicing them so they become really second nature. Having a break in and allowing yourself to have a break from alcohol, particularly over, you know, setting a time for having that break, allows you to experience how you feel without actually having it. So again, breaking that habit and breaking that, you know, expectation. So it's very much thinking through ways to both allow you to change that behavior, but also to allow you to change the way that you think about things and to challenge some of those thoughts that you might think the only way that you can have fun is by drinking, or the only way that you can have fun or interact at a party is by drinking. It's a really interesting experiment to go to a party and test that out. Can you actually have fun at a party without drinking? Now, I'm making this sound like it's super easy, and it isn't, and it takes as much practice as it takes, as we talked about earlier, to change your thinking and change the way that you talk about things. That's a really simple example of should. To change behavior takes as much practice and is effortful, like it is with the should example.
Changing your thinking is effortful. Making change on purpose requires a decent motivation so that you don't run from something and you can actually run to something.
It takes the commitment to actually see it through as well. You know, like, you know, I've talked about how I've sat with this for probably close to 2 years now. And if that's not commitment, I don't know what is. But also, it's not a commitment to say, fuck you, go away. It's actually a commitment from me to say, you know what, I'm going to have a look at myself. I'm going to actually remove myself from this situation so that I don't hurt myself anymore with it. But also to actually evaluate what my best move is.
Because even if we've made that decision out of a place of, fuck it, I'm done, and running from something, we can change the motivation going forward and bring it back around to something that's probably more healthy for us, like 2021 New South Wales Young Australian of the Year Nathan Parker did. When he spoke to us, he'd been in a bus crash, his arm was amputated, and
That dream of being a pilot though never ever left him.
I guess I was lucky in that it sort of became really apparent when I had that crossroads. It was I could stay in the military and do another job, which would have been an incredible experience and opportunity, but for me I already felt at that point that I'd lost that childhood dream twice. And I couldn't afford to sort of walk away. At the end of the day, when the chips are down, I couldn't walk away from flying without sort of working out what was possible. Because I had this gut feeling deep down that I knew in 10, 15 years' time, I'd be kicking myself that I didn't give it a shot and see what was possible. So for me, it was very obvious that at that point in time, at that crossroads, there was a very strong pull towards, you know, you need to give this a go. And given that you've already potentially lost it twice over, give it one last shot and see what is possible. But I think it's definitely a challenge. It's particularly these days with so many different things that are going on for so many of us. It's hard to narrow down what is it that we're passionate about and how do we find our passion? How do we pursue our passion? And that's something that I've been very lucky throughout my life to have had a very clear passion from the start.
Is that what fueled you when people said that you won't fly again? So it wasn't so much proving them wrong, but following your own gut on that they were wrong?
Yeah, I think for me it was about seeing what was possible. I knew deep down, I had a sense deep down that I think I can still do this. And I was very lucky along the way to have so many incredible people give me opportunities to try and see what was possible. But I mean, even thinking back to my hospital room, one of the first things that went up on the wall in my room was a picture of the fighter jet that I had always hoped to fly. And even in those tough times when it was struggling to put food in my mouth, you know, with only one hand, I'd look up that and think, you know, I've got to do this to start moving towards that goal. And there was no guarantees that I'd get back there, and unfortunately I wasn't able to pursue that dream in the long run. But at that point in time, that passion, that dream, and that goal gave me that inspiration, that motivation to keep pushing through no matter how hard things got.
So what I find really amazing about that is that if I was Nathan, I think I would have gone, fuck it, I'm gonna be a fighter pilot anyway to prove them wrong. But he didn't do it to prove them wrong. He did it because he had that feeling that he was moving towards something, that it was right.
that base feeling within himself that this is actually what is really important to me. And if there is another way to get that, then I will do that.
So where does that leave us on our personal stories?
What have you done?
I've opened a can of worms and we can't make it through. the truth is, the answer to that question is, we're humans in flux. There's no perfect ending here. We don't get to the end of this and the story's all wrapped up and it had a happy ending and it was all worth it in the end and we've achieved this massive thing of clarity. I mean, we're fucking humans trying to figure it out as we go and make healthier choices that benefit us in the long run. But those situations aren't resolved. You're not friends with the family again and I'm not friends with the ex. So,
Yeah, I don't know. There are different things that come up through life, you know, where there's something at stake, you know, and I guess we really just need to, like Nathan, think about what it is that we actually want, what's important to us. So, you know, while we can actually be forced into change and run away from something that we just don't like anymore or has really just kind of ground us down for so long, when we actually identify what it is that we do want and we make a commitment to that, that's when we can really get some energy behind it.
Even if we don't have the answers to where to now, I think what's really clear is that our commitment makes a difference to where we're headed, how important it is to us and what we're prepared to do to get there. So next time on Reframe of Mind, how about we chat to someone whose personal story is testament to staying true to your commitment?
Yeah, definitely. We have New Zealand professional endurance athlete, author and mindset expert, Lisa Tamati.
So I went all in and it nearly broke me. I had my own health dramas that I went through in that period of time because I just blew myself to pieces, but I got my mum back.
You've been hearing our story. Now we really want to hear yours.
Connect with at Reframe of Mind on Instagram, Facebook, TikTok.
Tired of ads crashing your comedy podcast party? Good news. Ad-free listening on Amazon Music is included with your Prime membership. Just head to amazon.com/adfreecomedy to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Enjoy thousands of Acast shows ad-free for Prime subscribers. Some shows may have ads.
And Twitter.
Or connect with at Welcome Change Media on LinkedIn.
You can also contact us via reframeofmind.com.au with your stories or suggestions for future topics.
We'd like to thank today's guests for sharing their personal stories and insights. And for more information on any of the subjects, guests or references used in this episode, please see our show notes or reframeofmind.com.au.
Reframe of Mind is a Welcome Change Media production.